This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we're pleased to bring you what we think is a profound analysis of the Trump phenomena.
We believe it's neo-fascism. We use the word quite purposely because if you don't know what it is, you can't fight it.
After President Barack Obama eased travel restrictions to Cuba in 2015, now the Trump administration seems to be reversing course.
In the name of human rights, Trump is now telling us that we can't go to Cuba unless we go in a group and that group is monitored and we have to report back on what we did and who we talked to.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian. Is Donald Trump a neo-fascist? Thoughtful analysts on the left, like Cornel West, Noam Chomsky, and Judith Butler, think he is. But mainstream liberal commentators refuse to associate the Trump phenomena with fascism. They call him a right-wing populist. What is neo-fascism? Right-wing populism. Does it really matter what Trump is called? The great German playwright and political thinker who lived in Germany during Hitler's reign, Bertolt Brecht, asked in 1935, "How can anyone tell the truth about fascism unless he's willing to speak out against capitalism, which brings it forth?" We speak today with John Bellamy Foster, editor of the venerable magazine Monthly Review. He wrote the lead article in the current June 2017 issue titled, "Why It's Not Populism." John Bellamy Foster is a professor of sociology at the University of Oregon. He writes about the political economy of capitalism and ecological crisis. John Bellamy Foster, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Glad to be here.
You think that we should characterize Donald Trump and his regime as neo-fascist. Why is it important to distinguish between calling Trumpism right-wing populist, as is commonly done, and neo-fascist, as you believe?
Well, it's a difficult issue because the term fascist is sometimes used just as a term of abuse, but words matter. And our conceptions matter. And to say Trump is a right-wing populist doesn't really tell us very much. Populist, in the way they're using it now, just means somebody, whether on the right or the left, who's critical of the liberal democratic center that's dominated U.S. politics and that has a mass following. So they refer to people such as Hitler or Chavez, Bernie Sanders, Marine Le Pen, all sorts of people all over the political spectrum as populist, simply because they are opposed to the center that has dominated U.S. and world politics. So you really have to talk about what something is. In order to understand it, you have to get down to the roots of the phenomenon. And in Europe, it's well known that there has been a transnational neo-fascist movement, and it has a very clear political, social basis, and it's part of the whole long genus of fascist movements. To understand this allows us to understand what is happening today, to put Trump and his movement in context and to be able to struggle against it.
John, at the outset of your monthly review article, "This Is Not Populism," you quote Adolf Hitler, who said, quote, "I am concerned with power politics. That is to say, I make use of all means that seem to me to be of service without the slightest concern for the proprieties or for codes of honor." We presume you had Donald Trump in mind?
Yes, of course. And I thought people would immediately get it. It sounded as if it came out of Trump's mouth and really described him in some ways.
You write about Germany, and you talk about what classes in Germany Hitler drew his support. And do you think that there's a similarity in Germany and now here in the United States with Trump and where he gets his support?
Yes, there's. I was very influenced by a Gallup study that came out that said exactly that. It came out in, I think it was in early November, not long before the election. But there's quite an understanding of this in the literature. The Hitler's support came, his electoral support in the beginning when he was running for office, was from the lower middle class, or petty bourgeoisie, as they sometimes call it, and from some privileged sectors of the working class, but particularly from what we know as the lower middle class, the semi-professionals, the lower-level white-collar workers, owners of small businesses, and people who are better off than the working class in general, but in a fairly precarious position. And then he drew support from privileged sectors of the working class, from rural voters, from religious Protestants, and so on. But the basis of fascist political power has always been rooted in the lower middle class during periods of crisis, when that part of the population is thrown into a reactionary mode. And it also involves an alliance, and this is important, it also involves an alliance with sectors of wealth, with monopoly capital, and or today monopoly finance capital. So there's an alliance between the lower middle class operating in a very reactionary mode and the very top of the wealth hierarchy.
You write that Trump in his election campaign had a, quote, neo-fascist strategy of enlisting mass support through racist and nativist appeals to lower middle class insecurities while allying with core elements of the ruling class. Can you expand on that thought, please?
Well, that really is the traditional neo-fascist strategy. Is to it plays up to the reactionary elements of this part of the population, particularly when there isn't a strong left. So that the lack of a strong left prevents them from having an analysis that might incorporate them within a more democratic project. And the problems that are experienced by people in this sector of the population are then blamed on immigrants, racial groups, a whole nationalist, ethnic, racist philosophy is promoted. And there are criticisms, of course, of crony capitalists at the top and of the elites, but this is accompanied by attacks on marginalized populations everywhere. And this is a phenomenon that we know historically, and that is the basis of creating a fascist or neo-fascist movement. They rely particularly on sub-intellectual appeals to emotion. They draw very heavily on people who are in fairly privileged, relatively privileged positions with respect to the working class, but are less educated. And all of this is part of what's made fascism work in the past in its different forms.
You write that ultimately, however, the neo-fascist project, like classical fascism before it, relies on an alliance of the lower middle class with monopoly finance capital, leading ultimately to the betrayal of the movement's mass base. Is this already happening here in America? And in whose interest do the fascists really govern?
Well, it's very complicated. If you look at, say, Trump's White House, a lot is made in the news of the fact that there are two wings that are in conflict. One is represented by Kushner, Trump's son-in-law, and the other one by Steve Bannon. And Kushner basically represents the financial sector, real estate, big capital. He's more of an economic than a political figure. While Bannon represents the alt-right within the administration, Breitbart, and the neo-fascist political strategy specifically aimed at the lower middle class that was so important in bringing Trump into power. Both of these elements are necessary to the overall working of this political strategy. But Trump's alliance allegiances and, well, of course, Kushner's are mainly to the rich, to capitalism, to monopoly finance capital. So ultimately, he will follow that course. But he has to hold on to this popular lower middle class base, which is, say, the rear guard of the capitalist system, as C. Wright Mills called it. And so he has to constantly tell them that he is fulfilling his pledges to them. In fact, Steve Bannon has been shown with a whiteboard with all of Trump's pledges, mainly to the lower middle class, and with a list of his pledges on immigration, actually checking them off. And then this is put on Breitbart and actually over through the whole media. And this is meant to say that he's fulfilling his pledges to the lower middle class. But the big play, like the tax reductions, the reduction of the corporate tax from 35% max to 15%. These things, or the 75% reduction in regulations on business that he's promised, this is really about playing to monopoly finance capital, to big capital, and that's where Trump really will take his stand. But if he wants to win another election, if he wants to move forward, he somehow has to hold on to this lower middle class, particularly political base, and the alt-right, and that whole strategy as well. So it's a difficult thing to accomplish. There are betrayals that are likely to occur in this process. You know, ultimately, if he gets reelected, which isn't beyond the realm of possibility under these circumstances, he will probably betray his lower middle class base big time, because he won't need them anymore.
John, Trump got only a majority of the vote and less votes than Clinton got by 3 million. Do you think we should take any comfort in that fact?
Well, you can take comfort in whatever you want, but the politics is about winning, and the electoral college system is the system that we have. The whole basis of the higher vote of Clinton's was a higher percentage in urban areas, but the political system is set up so that rural areas have more clout than the electoral college system. Basically sets it up so that the elections aren't based simply on the majority. And the key to Trump's electoral college victory was he managed to win in the Rust Belt states, in the Midwest, which had formerly been in industrialized states, blue collar, and he managed to win in these states. Of course, you could say that given that a lot of people refused to vote, many more refused to vote or didn't vote than in the case of Obama's last election, that it was more a question of Democratic voters walking away than Republicans winning. But whatever you want, however you want to look at it, it still remains true that he managed to pull off the electoral vote in the Rust Belt states, which were traditionally blue states and basically the core of Democratic Party power for many, many years. And this has to do with his appeal to the lower middle class and to privileged sectors of the working class that have been really hurting in neoliberal times. So there's not much comfort in just having a majority of a popular vote. You actually have to win the Electoral College in an electoral contest in the United States. More important than that, it points to the fact the Democratic Party has lost a lot of its connection to workers.
Adolf Hitler came into power in Germany legally. He always pretended to uphold the rule of law, even as he was subverting it. Why is this important, and is this happening now, here?
Well, I think it's important in a number of respects. One of the things is when we talk about fascist tendencies, and the use of the term populism or right-wing populism is often used as a cloak for fascism or neo-fascism to legitimize it and to bring it within the acceptable range of politics. And the whole problem of fascism is complicated by the fact that people think have very little knowledge of what it was or what the basis of fascist state. So they'll look at things like, well, there's still adherence to the rule of law, or there's a welfare state, and they'll say, well, this proves that Trump is not anti-democratic or is not fascist, or that some people even say, well, he's a centrist or a leftist, and it creates an enormous amount of confusion. We have to understand that when the fascist states came to power, they did so partly through the rule of law, but then they subverted the political and legal institutions, and they promoted a welfare state in Italy and Germany. So it doesn't conform to what people usually think. And in order to have clarity about these things, we have to understand that. Hitler always said that he was sticking with the Weimar Constitution, but he used provisions within the Weimar Constitution's the notorious Article 48, and which allowed the government in an emergency to basically eliminate the influence of the legislature, the parliament. He used such measures like that to take over complete power. And they called the whole process of bringing the various institutions of the state into line, they called it Gleichschaltung. It means bringing into line. And what we see under Trump is, at least initially, but his government's been very beleaguered lately by Russiagate, but we see an attempt to assault the various parts of the state and to bring them into a line with the White House. We see attacks on civil liberties, And all of these things are significant. And if there was a major emergency that arose in the United States, such as a terrorist attack, there's very little doubt that Trump would use similar provisions that have now been established by law in the United States following the Patriot Act to drastically reduce civil liberties in the country. But it would be done under the cover of legality.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. I edited a book of William Kunstler's writings and speeches 13 years ago, and I called it The Emerging Police State, and Michael Ratner wrote the introduction. And we got a lot of heat for calling it that. We said, oh, you're alarmist and so on. But I think that the infrastructure for a police state really has been set up. And I think if there is a crisis, and Naomi Klein has been talking about this recently, if there's a crisis, they could certainly bring those laws into bear and really clamp down on us. Let me ask you this, John. Bertolt Brecht asked in 1935, how can anyone tell the truth about fascism unless he's willing to speak out against capitalism, which brings it forth? Would you say that in the last 40 years of American neoliberalism, capitalism, under both the Democrats and the Republicans, they've brought forth the Trump phenomena?
Well, yeah, certainly. Neoliberalism, which was this really, neoliberalism started as a response to the slowdown of the economy, the stagnation of the economy that emerged in the 1970s. And then it transformed itself into basically the political program of monopoly finance capital or a finance-driven and concentrated economic system. And so neoliberalism has been expropriating the assets of the population. It's been breaking unions. It's been eliminating aspects of the welfare state. It's been privatizing education, and so on. And this is part of the. This is really the main trajectory of the monopoly finance capital system at present. And the result has been to turn more and more of the population against what are called the elites, because people are hurting, because inequality is going up massively in the society. And neoliberalism has become so unpopular that in order to stabilize the system, some of those at the top believe that we have to go in a neo-fascist direction, that is, reduce any threat from democracy. And this is a traditional response of capitalism in crisis. And one of the key way to do that is to take advantage of lower middle class that is easily pushed in reactionary directions, particularly in terms when there is a weak left. So if you look at Breitbart, which is the central organ of the alt-right, and of course Bannon still manages Breitbart, he's been allowed to do that within the Trump administration. Breitbart is funded by monopoly finance capital, by some of the biggest billionaires in the United States, and it's aimed entirely, though, at the lower middle class and privileged sectors of the working class, and promoting nationalism, racial hatred, patriarchy, anti-immigrant attitudes, and so on. And this is a political strategy to create a neo-fascist political spectrum that can stabilize the system, because the system is characterized now by economic stagnation, long-term economic stagnation, prone to financial crises, and there will be another big financial crisis, and by declining U.S. Economic hegemony and rising inequality. So how do you stabilize such a system? they have basically moved, or a spectrum of the capitalist class is moving towards neo-fascism as a way of stabilizing neoliberalism or replacing it.
John, we just have a few minutes remaining. Do you think building and reforming the Democratic Party is a productive way to fight back against Trumpism?
Well, the short answer is no, but the long answer is quite a bit longer. You know, Bernie Sanders is historically one of the biggest critics of the Democratic Party and always said you really couldn't change things within the Democratic Party. But he has moved now towards trying to shift the whole nature of the Democratic Party. That's incredibly difficult to do, and I don't think it will happen. But more important than that is that if we're going to build a electoral political movement, you have to have an extra electoral movement. You have to build a political base at the bottom of society. You have to build alternatives. There have to be other organizations at the bottom of the society and mass organization, mass movements that define their own objectives. And I think it will only be rational and systematic if it's socialist, aimed at substantive equality for all people. But this has to happen, and the Democratic Party is controlled by certain political elites, and more than that, by the capitalist class. What we have to do is build a political momentum of a different kind at the base of the society, and that could conceivably change the Democratic Party into something else, or we create something else. But without the base movement, nothing will happen. We'll have Democratic Party is dedicated to neoliberalism and capitalism, and it really has to be abandoned ultimately if we're going to go forward.
John Bellamy Foster, how can people listening today follow your work?
Well, I'm editor of the Monthly Review, so you can find all sorts of things about me in articles on Monthly Review. And in this context, I have a little book coming out called Trump in the White House, which will be out in a couple of months, and that will be a low-cost, short book and something that will present these ideas more systematically.
Well, we look forward to talking to you when the book comes out. We'll help you launch it, John.
That'd be wonderful. Thanks so much.
Thank you, John.
Yeah, thank you so much for being on Law & Disorder, John Bellamy Foster. Have a good day.
You too.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
D.C. And anything you want to know about Washington, D.C., please talk to me, because I can tell you about it. But we rode all around in the rain. No colored people wouldn't let me in because I was with a white man. And that's a police walk place because they're scared to let in colored people if they're with white people.
On June 15, President Donald Trump traveled to Miami to condemn Cuba for gross human rights violations. He did this as he signed an executive order aimed at reversing the process of normalization of relations between Cuba and the United States that has been going on since December 2014.
Trump spoke to a dwindling base of hardened reactionaries in Miami. He accused Cuba of, quote, spreading violence and instability, end quote, as justification to increase restrictions on the travel of Americans to Cuba and to double down on the blockade by eliminating any business dealings with Cuban state-run enterprises administered by the Cuban military.
Now, for an American citizen to go to the small island 90 miles from Florida, they must go with a group, with a minder, and report everywhere they travel and with whom they meet.
Since the success of the 1959 Cuban Revolution, the United States government has been trying to reverse it and restore capitalist property relations on the island of 11 million people.
The Cuban Revolution truly was a revolution, and not in the Madison Avenue sense of the word. It was not superficial, but profoundly fundamental. The 99%, poor peasants, city workers, and intellectuals, overthrew the 1%. The super rich, the large landowners, the owners of the utilities and mines. The 99% took back their own country, and the 1% largely moved to Miami. 50,000 Cubans died in their struggle.
From then until now, the policy and practice of the United States government has been to take Cuba back, change the regime, and reintroduce capitalist property relations by any means necessary.
At first, U.S.-backed terrorism torched sugar crops because land was taken from the rich and redistributed to the peasants. The U.S. supported the assassination of teachers during the hugely successful literacy drive. The CIA introduced dengue fever and swine flu, killing children and livestock alike. They supported a full-scale military invasion in 1962, known as the Bay of Pigs. It failed. The U.S. initially succeeded in isolating Cuba politically, diplomatically, and economically.
Latin American and Caribbean governments were overthrown by the CIA if they didn't go along with this policy. Only Mexico held out. But this tactic didn't work. Cuba overcame the isolation. The U.S. itself became isolated for its hostility. Then, in 2014, the Organization of American States told the United States that unless it allowed Cuba to rejoin the OAS, the United States itself was unwelcome.
So the USA, led by President Barack Obama, changed tactics, but not its goal to restore capitalism to Cuba. In July 2015, Cuba was recognized. Embassies were opened in Havana and Washington. Trade and travel restrictions were eased.
This all has been recently partly reversed by President Donald Trump. We speak today with Sandra Levinson, the director of the Center for Cuban Studies. Ms. Levinson has taught college at Hunter College in CCNY. She's traveled to Cuba hundreds of times, including 9 times in the last several months. And she's been a pioneer, in establishing relationships between American citizens and Cubans. Sandra Levinson, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thanks, Michael.
President Trump instructed the Treasury Department to issue regulations that'll end people-to-people travel. Previously, U.S. citizens could make up their own agenda when they went to Cuba. What's it going to be like now if somebody wants to travel to Cuba?
Well, of course, a lot hasn't changed. For one thing, the 12 categories under which you can travel legally still exist. So if you're a journalist or you're going on a religious trip or you're going on a humanitarian trip, or you're an academic doing professional research, or you're a doctor, lawyer, social worker. All of those categories that people checked off when climbing onto JetBlue or some other airline still exist. The only category that doesn't exist is the people-to-people category, which now flips back to where it was before Obama. And instead of being under a general license, is under a so-called specific license, which simply means that if you are going to travel for reasons other than professional research or journalism or something very specific, you are expected to travel in a group. Now, there has been no indication of what constitutes a group. For example, most of the Center for Cuban Studies groups since January, I mean, I personally have led 7 trips since January, have all been very small. That is, maximum number 9 people, and that's usually because it's a family and grandparents, parents, children all go. But I think that generally people who have traveled to Cuba in all of these years have been accustomed to going as groups, and it's only been in the last couple of years that people have been able to think they can go by just getting a plane reservation and going. I think that for Trump, he made it sound worse than it is, because I think what he was really trying to do was, first of all, of course, go along with whatever Marco Rubio said he should say, but secondly, scare people off. You know, I mean, a lot of people have been calling us at the center, and their impression is that they like simply can't go any longer unless they go with a recognized group. And that's not true. That's not true.
So if somebody, a couple of people, say friends from college, want to go check out the situation in Havana, and they buy a JetBlue ticket and they somehow get a place to stay at a hotel, they can just go? You think that they'll be okay?
Yes. What they should do, however, and this is why I said it's important that we don't yet know what the U.S. government thinks constitutes a group. I mean, they may say, and we have had 2- and 3-person groups, you know.
Yeah.
There will be 2 couples or whatever. And what they do is they come to us for that full-time schedule that they are supposed to go with. And we say, what are you interested in? And they say, you know, we're interested in art. What we want to do is visit artists. We want to visit art schools. And we set that up for them. Now, what is more difficult is that Trump's statement said that the groups cannot go alone. They have to go with, as some people have put it, including Art Heitzer, they have to go with a minder. You know, well, I don't like to think of myself as a minder, but rather as an enabler. But whatever that, however that may be, I think that, you know, if they demand, and they didn't say that the licensed organization, which we are, that the licensed organization has to send someone from their organization. They use the term agent as well, which suggests to me that someone in Cuba, you know, for example, someone who works with us in Cuba could be our agent, so that we don't have to send someone with these 2 people, but rather put them in the hands of someone in Cuba who will take them around to where they have to go in order to fulfill the demanded regulations. I mean, it's all a little, you know, we have no idea how much will be enforced. Are they really going to follow people around to make sure you're not eating in a military restaurant or that you haven't checked into a military hotel? Most of these people traveling individually or in small groups have been staying in B&Bs anyway, which are not run by the military, but by poor Cubans trying to make a buck, you know?
Yeah. The other thing is that what are they going to do about it? There was so much dissatisfaction and resistance to the policy back in 2006. They stopped prosecuting people. You know, there were criminal and civil penalties, as you well know,
yes,
for people that you could go to Cuba, you just couldn't spend money there. And so for people that went there and spent money, technically they were breaking the law, and they still are, except that they didn't have enough judges and they just stopped prosecuting people. Do you think that situation still obtains?
Well, I think, you know, first of all, I think we have to make very clear that people understand that there are no prohibitions against travel. There cannot be. It would be unconstitutional.
That's right.
That there are prohibitions against spending money in Cuba unless you fall into one of the 12 categories, unless. And so it's very important that people understand that they are not traveling to Cuba illegally. If they do not fit into the 12 categories and they do not go with a group, and they have not consulted with a group in order to have a full-time schedule and have someone to take them around, then the spending of money is illegal. And I cannot see the Treasury Department going along with a demand to add hundreds of people to the roles of the Office of Foreign Assets Control, OFAC, when they should be paying attention to North Korea or Russia or China, and instead they're going to be following around individual U.S. citizens who have the right or should have the right to travel anywhere they choose.
You know, you mentioned our friend Art Heitzer. Art, of course, is the chairman of the National Lawyers Guild Cuba Subcommittee. And when Trump made his statement, Art responded by saying, and I'm going to ask you your comments on what Art said. Art said, quote, corralling U.S. travelers into groups with a U.S. minder is antithetical to the proclamation that these restrictions are issued in order to uphold freedom. That was Art's observation. Your thoughts, true. Sandy?
Well, of course, it's perfectly true. And then as Art continued in his statement, as I recall, he talked about the absurdity of pointing out human rights in Cuba not being human enough. We don't even have to comment on that, given the countries that President Trump seems to be most friendly with and most interested in doing business with.
I know. I was gonna ask you about that later on in the interview, because he just came back from Saudi Arabia, where they behead sorcerers, and he's talking about Cuba. We'll get to that in a second. But first, I just wanted to ask you something else, though. Two-thirds of the United States population, including Cuban Americans, are for normalization of relations. And how do you explain Trump's backward move?
Well, I explain Trump's backward move the way we explain almost everything he does, which is to play to his base. I don't think everyone says, well, this is because of the Cuban Americans and they're a very important part of his base. They're not a very important part of his base, and I'm sure he knows that. He's talking to the people who don't know anything about Cuba, who don't know anything about how Cuban Americans think. The people who voted for him, who he just wants to keep going with this kind of message. I'm doing what I said I would do during the campaign, and I said I would get rid of Obamacare, and I said I would get rid of good relations with Cuba. And, you know, the very fact that Trump has said that anyone who's already got a business deal going with Cuba, i.e. before he announced the changes, or really before the Treasury Department comes out with the regulations, can go ahead.
Yeah. So I mean,
what is he really saying?
Are we talking smoke and mirrors here?
I think so. Yeah, I think so. Like much of what he does. It's all bluster.
Sandra Levinson, you've been to Cuba hundreds of times.
Yes.
I want to ask you whether you'd agree with the statement that the Cuban government issued after Trump's declaration. The Cuban government said, "We reject the political manipulation and double standard in the treatment of the issue of human rights. The Cuban people enjoy fundamental rights and freedoms and exhibit achievements that we all feel proud of, and that an illusion in many other countries of the world, including the United States, such as the right to health, education, social security, equal pay for equal work, the rights of children, the right to food, peace, and development. With its modest resources, Cuba has also contributed to the improvement of human rights in many parts of the world, despite limitations imposed on it by the conditions of being blockaded by your country." How did you react to that Cuban statement?
Well, I think they should have stopped after the first sentence. I think that says it all. You know, he's got a double standard. I think that those of us on the left have always attempted to define human rights in a much broader way than they are traditionally defined in the United States, as though the only human right is the right to free expression, for
example.
Yeah,
really. They're taking away meals on wheels.
Right. I mean, but we don't care about, starving people. We don't care about taking away their jobs. We don't consider those human rights. And I think you and I do consider those human rights, and clearly the Cubans consider them human rights. And, you know, as we were saying before, the very fact that Trump can say that about Cuba while praising Saudi Arabia or any number of countries he's been praising lately because they're more important to him economically. I do not say to us, but to him economically. But Cuba, you know, Cuba's problem to a great extent vis-a-vis the United States has always been that it's not quite big enough, not quite powerful enough, not quite important enough for us to pay real attention to.
They've paid attention to Cuba in one respect. Since when? 1962, the Cubans have been blockaded. There's an embargo against Cuba that extends not just to Cuba, but to other countries that even trade with Cuba. How has that affected Cuban development?
Yes, and that's the fact that we have gotten away with it is because no one has risen up. There aren't enough people in this country to rise up and say, hey, wait a minute, what about the 11 million Cubans that we're trying to starve, that we're trying to push to overthrow their government, that we're trying to do all the things we say we are against? I mean, clearly, the imposition of an embargo that has lasted so long, the only exception to the embargo happened several years ago when the embargo on food and medicine was lifted. And that came with a great big uh-oh, because the United States government said that people wanting to sell pharmaceuticals and farm products to Cuba could not sell on credit, unlike the way they sell to every other country in the world, that the Cubans had to pay up front. Well, essentially, that means also keeping the embargo on food and medicines, because how can the Cubans pay up front for everything? And what this has done to Cuba internally is to completely distort the way in which a socioeconomic and political system grows, changes, etc. What Cuba has had to do is respond always to what the United States is doing to it. And I say that really before, with the exception of Jimmy Carter, as you know, who lifted the travel ban and who tried to bring about normalization of relations. And my guess is that if he'd been elected a second time around, we wouldn't even be sitting here talking about this. But the fact is that what the embargo has done to Cuba is made them live all these years under a state of siege with a ration book, with shortages. And people who try to say, to put the blame all on Cuba and say, well, it's because they haven't done their work agriculturally or they haven't really tried to overcome the embargo. You can't overcome an embargo imposed by the United States government against Cuba. You can't overcome it. And the very fact that Cuba has survived is, in my opinion, a way of overcoming it. I mean, the fact is that Cuba has survived, which is kind of a miracle, right?
Well, it's a testament to the patriotism and nationalism of that country.
And to their resilience, Michael, their resilience. I mean, they basically can take whatever we throw at them.
And their accomplishments. So we were in Cuba together, Sandy. We went and visited a number of artists. I mean, after the Russian Revolution, arts flourished in Russia for several years. Well, after the Cuban Revolution of 1959, it's still flourishing. It's quite amazing. Song and dance and the plastic arts, theater. It's just unbelievable.
It is unbelievable. People are always shocked at, you know, the level of intellect, the level of talent. And, you know, you have to give that credit where credit is due.
Really. And they've in the face of the embargo, done some things that are really worth mentioning. I want to mention two. One is they've developed a medicine for lung cancer that's, I think, 70% effective. And they've also developed a medicine for people with diabetes to prevent amputations. And and it's a shame that there's not normal relationships between our countries. I have my own friend lost a leg because of diabetes. It didn't have to happen had there been relations with the Cuban
government.
And
only now are they starting to do the drug trials on the lung cancer vaccine, only now. And it's been operative in Cuba for, I think, 10 years now.
Yeah, it's amazing. But I wanted to ask you to recount a personal story for us, because I'm so proud of you, Sandra Levinson. There was a blockade buying Cuban art. And some of the great art in the world comes out of Cuba, and you couldn't get it, and you couldn't bring it here. And you took the initiative, and you're not even an attorney. Tell us the story.
Well, you know, the absurd thing was that actually all informational materials, in other words, all those free speech materials, were not allowed to come into into the United States from Cuba. But in 1987, Congress passed a law allowing all informational materials to come into the United States from any other country, right, including Cuba. And I think that was done so people wouldn't think it was really done to let Cuban materials come in. But when the Treasury Department finally got around to listing all of what constitutes informational materials, you know, the obvious ones, the books, the magazines, the periodicals, and then when you get music CDs, DVDs, whatever was available at the time. But then when it came to art, they listed reproductions, photographs, prints, but not drawings and not paintings and not sculpture and not ceramics. And, you know, basically we said, you know, we went to our attorney, whom we both know and love, who is also the attorney for the Cuban government, Michael Krinsky, and said, hey, you know, this doesn't make any logical sense. You know, why isn't painting included? Why aren't drawings? And he said, oh, come on, Sandy, you know why? Because we don't want Fidel Castro to get the money that they could get from original art. I said, but that doesn't make any logical sense. It's informational, just like all the other art. He said, no. He said, you know, they'll never go along with that. Finally, he said, okay, look, if you do all the research and you do all the grunt work, then I'll take it to court along with the National Emergency Civil Liberties Committee. And that's what we did, you know. And the judge was great. I mean, the judge basically looked at the Treasury Department lawyer and said, do you really intend to carry this forward? And meanwhile, he had in front of him all of our materials that we had so painfully put together, the slides, all the interviews I did with you know, academics saying, you know, the only real information about a piece of art comes from the original piece of art, right? And he looked at the Treasury Department guy and said, do you really intend to carry this case forward? And the lawyer said, of course, Your Honor, why wouldn't I? And the judge said, well, because I can tell you right now, if I'm the sitting judge in this case, you don't have a chance. And the Treasury Department lawyer basically surrendered on the spot. And so that's, you know, it was a terrific win. And I think it's something that has made it possible for many, many people in the United States to enjoy the fruits of Cuban art education and what Cubans feel about their country. And, you know, whether it's positive or negative, the art field flourishes. And people who say, well, you're not allowed to do dissident art, just don't know what's going on in Cuba, if they think that.
You know, the Center for Cuban Studies has a gallery right
Oh, yes,
and
we even
Chelsea.
Did a Fidel in Cuban art last September, yeah. In sort of in celebration of his 90th birthday. And people would come and say, they'd look at a piece of, you know, kind of critical art, and they would say, well, of course, this wasn't done by a Cuban in Cuba, right? And it was done by a Cuban in Cuba, yes.
Well, let's talk about the art gallery and the Center for Cuban Studies. When did you start it, and why did you start it, and how's it going?
Well, we started it, and I'll tell you how it's going. We're having a tough time. But 1972 is when we started, and we started as a library. Because at that time, nobody was going to Cuba. No journalists were traveling there. No academics were traveling there. And there was very little information about Cuba except for the very, you know, the kind of propaganda that was obvious in the mass media. And so what we wanted to do was to start a library that would make it possible for us to bring in at least books and magazines and periodicals. We didn't know it was illegal. And apparently most of the government didn't know it was illegal at the time either. and to, you know, make these kinds of information, research materials, available to people who were teaching, people who were writing about Latin America, about the Caribbean. And so it really started as a way to bring, we brought movies in because the Cuban movies weren't allowed to be distributed in this country. So the Cuban Film Institute simply gave us the films. They really provided our first kind of income. They gave us the films to use as we would like. And so for a lot of people, that was their first introduction to the wonderful Cuban film industry. And that's what we did. You know, we started as a library and a lecture series and talking about imperialism in Latin America, the relationship between Cuba and the United States. And many, many people were beginning to travel there. They went as guests of the Cuban government. And that meant that they were not spending money. I mean, all of our early trips, which we started in 1973, were made up of people who were invited by the Cuban government. Our first one was lawyers, Michael. We were very smart to have our first trip be made up of lawyers, including Michael Krinsky, who was just a young new attorney.
Yeah, and Michael Ratner many times.
And yes, I mean, all of these people all went down originally as guests of the Cuban government. And then, you know, we were victims of a bombing 8 months after we opened, which made it clear that we were in a standoff position with some Cuban exiles.
I remember that because your office was then in the Village on Barrow Street.
That's right. It was right across the street from my apartment.
And right down the block from where I live. Anyway, I think we're running out of time, Sandra Levinson. The Center for Cuban Studies is a great institution. If people want to visit it, if they live in New York, talk about the center, where you are, and then let's end up on our advice to people who want to travel to Cuba.
Okay, well, we're at 231 West 29th Street between 7th and 8th, and we have an art gallery which always has a show going on. We have a wonderful show now, and we will throughout the summer. And we are there we're there 6 days a week, Monday through Saturday, 11 to 7 Monday through Friday, and 12 to 6 on Saturday. And we make special appointments outside of those hours. And we're especially interested in being able to help people travel to Cuba the way they want to travel, you know, either individually or in small groups. We do a lot of consulting work with people who want to travel to Cuba. And I suppose that now we'll do even more.
Yeah.
The main thing is we really want people to come and see this little corner of Cuba in the middle of Chelsea in Manhattan because, you know, there's nothing like it. We have 10,000 works of art on site.
That's spectacular. And not just paintings, but arts
and crafts. 5,000 are posters. Yeah. In fact, on June 30th in Santiago de Cuba, we're opening an exhibit there in the best gallery in Santiago of 175 of our 1960s and 1970s posters, which it's incredible to think that we have them and they don't.
Yeah.
So, you know, I took them down to Cuba on my last trip and they're being put up and I'm going to be there for the opening. And, you know, we can help people in a lot of ways. Many people bring their classes. We'll talk to the classes about graphic design or about something having to do with art or about the relations between the United States and Cuba. We have lecture series and film showings and a gift shop and books for sale. And we try to do everything we can so that people can be more informed about Cuba.
It's one of those shining places in Manhattan. Sandra Levinson, the head of the Center for Cuban Studies, thank you so much for being on Law and Disorder. We'll link to the center on lawanddisorder.org. And we're so glad to see you and grateful for your coming down for the interview. Thank you, Sandra.
Thank you very much, Michael. I love being here.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org. On the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.